Hey, I'm filling in for Paul Mute this week, and I'm looking for the show that we prepared here. This is Bob Polesny. Wonderful show again by Carol and Aaron Ammons, bringing you higher ground here. And I remind you about the Votercade happening this afternoon from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, kicking off over there at Country Fair Shopping Center, wrapping up over at Lincoln Square. And, oh, there she is. Got renamed on me. See if we can kick this off right now. News from Neptune. Paul's got a little bit of Amy Goodman on here. A little bit of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And then a longer thing about surveillance capitalism. And we'll just kick it off this way here.
This is WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio, another episode of News from Neptune, the radio edit following that great show, Higher Ground. Today, I am absent, and I thank Bob Polesny for doing continuity on this show. I won't have a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal. He sounds like a good voice after his surgery. He gave a birthday greetings to his comrades in Berlin, and there's a bit of German in it, and it's already a week past May Day. But Janine Jackson is interviewed by a radio producer at WPFWC, Washington, D.C., Jazz and Justice Radio. So that'll follow Amy Goodman's commentary, which is about the grisly details of the aftermath of the MOVE bombing and burning in Philadelphia. Many of the MOVE people have commented on Mumia. He was their advocate and a good friend of the ground there. So keep that in mind when you hear this. This episode doesn't have anything about COVID, and I've been talking about the TRIPS agreement, intellectual property that the patents. Looks like Germany might be the stumbling block. I was speculating that maybe Switzerland would take the hit with some colleagues when we were talking about this issue. Our Buy-Dole Act that allowed pharmaceuticals and other companies to patent research developed under government contract itself includes the ability of the federal government to enjoin licensing of patents. And the Defense Production Act could be used instead of blocking the shipment overseas of inputs to pharmaceuticals and vaccinations. It actually could be used to promote the production and distribution of these necessary inputs.
Princeton and UPenn teach with the bones of murdered children. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Philadelphia's racist past resurfaced in recent weeks with the public disclosure that the bones of one or two African-American children killed by the city's police in 1985 were being used in an online Princeton University course called Real Bones, Adventures in Forensic Anthropology, without the knowledge of their families. May 13th marks the 36th anniversary of the day the city of Philadelphia bombed its own citizens. On that day in 1985, police surrounded the home of MOVE, a radical black liberation organization that was defying orders to vacate. Police flooded the home with water, filled the house with tear gas, and blasted the house with automatic weapons, all failing to dislodge the residents. Finally, police dropped a bomb on the house from a helicopter, killing 11 people, 6 adults, and 5 children. The fire burned an entire city block to the ground, destroying over 60 homes. An earlier standoff in 1978 ended in a hail of police gunfire, leaving one police officer dead. MOVE members say they didn't fire a shot and that the officer was a victim of friendly fire. Nevertheless, 9 MOVE members were convicted of his murder and given life sentences. One of those MOVE 9 prisoners, Debbie Africa, secretly gave birth in her cell just 5 weeks into her sentence. She managed to keep her son, Mike Africa Jr., with her for 3 days before alerting the guards. 7 of the MOVE 9 are now free after serving 40 years. 2 died in prison. Last month, Abdulali Muhammad, a grassroots organizer in Philadelphia, learned that the bones from 1 or 2 of the children killed in the 1985 MOVE bombing, Trey and Delisha Africa, were being used by Princeton University, along with the University of Pennsylvania's Penn Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, in the online course.
The bones are, we would say like juicy, you know, meaning that you can tell that they are of a recently deceased individual. They have a lot of sort of sheen to them, at least this one does. And that is because, of course, there's still marrow in the marrow cavity, and it's sort of leaching basically out and into the bone. So it gives that kind of slick sort of appearance. If you smell it, it doesn't actually smell bad, but it smells just kind of greasy.
That's Janet Monge, a Penn Museum curator, speaking in the video as she handles the bones.
Tree and Delisha, I knew them both.
Mike Africa Jr., now in his early 40s, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, responding to the discovery of the bones.
Tree was the oldest of all the kids. She was very kind, and she was very responsible, and she was always being called on to help with the other kids because she was the oldest. All of us were, unconventional orphans. Like, we were all together because all of our parents were in prison. Tree's parent, her mother was in prison. Delisha's, both her parents were in prison. And of course, my parents were in prison too.
After the conclusion of an official inquiry, not long after the bombing, Tree's remains were reportedly buried along with those of her half-sister, Zanetta. According to press reports, the remains of the other children, including Delisha, were later handed over to a state senator who ran a funeral home and had them buried in unmarked graves. If the bones of Tree and Delisha were buried in 1985, how did they end up in Janet Monge's hands 36 years later? Immediately after the bombing, the Philadelphia Medical Examiner brought in Alan Mann, an anthropology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, to help identify the bodies recovered from the rubble of the MOVE house. Janet Monge was a graduate student working under Mann. Mann's findings were later contradicted by Ali Z. Hameli, a forensic pathologist brought in by the city to conduct a subsequent in-depth investigation into the remains of the 11 victims. Hameli criticized the medical examiner for mishandling the MOVE remains. The medical examiner, for unknown reasons, released some of the remains to Mann. He allegedly kept them for decades, moving from the University of Pennsylvania to Princeton University. Alan Mann, now retired, first said he didn't have the bones of Tree and Delisha Africa, then reportedly recently transferred them to a funeral home in Philadelphia. Abdulali Muhammad learned of the bones, which have been described as an open secret in the anthropology community, when trying to facilitate the Penn Museum's repatriation of skulls of enslaved people held in its Morton collection. Like Harvard's 22,000 human remains and the Smithsonian's estimated 30,000 human remains, the Morton Collection skulls are a grim testament to institutional racism.
People are suffering and have been suffering for over 36 years just because of the bombing.
Again, that's Mike Africa Jr. As to what should happen to the remains of his friends Tree and Delisha, he says,
be decided by their parents.
The Philadelphia City Council issued an apology last November for the MOVE bombing. Reparations should be made to the community for the crimes committed against them, from the beatings to the bombing to the bones. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Indeed, there's some scenes of the MOVE burning in the Philly DA documentary, which I recommend to binge, or if you haven't been watching it. It has a bit about the damaged goods that was the Philadelphia police force at the time and the publicity machine that the Federation of Police operated. So here's Janine Jackson, who's with FAIR. Counterspin is a program that's here on WEFT.
Okay, this is Netflix Freeman. I'm speaking with Janine Jackson. Janine is FAIR, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the media watchdog. Janine is FAIR's program director and producer, host of FAIR's syndicated weekly radio show, Counterspin. And she contributes frequently to FAIR's newsletter, Extra, and co-edited the FAIR Reader, an extra review of press and politics in the 90s. Janine has also contributed to the documentary, The Framing of an Execution, The Case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Janine, welcome to Voice of Blue Vision.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I wanted to talk to you about some things regarding Mumia's getting more attention from the movement, but not necessarily any love or coverage from the media, at least not nationally. I wanted to kind of go into that. I remember that documentary that you were in, and I've seen that FAIR has covered Mumia over the years and have been able to, you know, because of what you do, give particular attention to the media's role in things with that. And so I wanted to ask you about some of those things. In the early outset of the case of Mumia, corporate media that's coverage was clearly not on Mumia's side, and you showed that in the documentary, The Framing of an Execution. The media bias can be done in two ways, right? It can be either, you know, it can either sideline or bury a story that's clearly newsworthy, or it can sensationalize it with a lot of bad coverage and information. With Mumia, it seemed to initially be the latter. What can you tell us about how that decision could have been made in the case of Mumia, or what determined this avenue in those formidable years? And please share anything you might know about the difference between local media coverage and the national coverage of his case.
Well, one of the things that's interesting, Netfa, is that corporate media did both. They slanted media both by not covering things that were worth covering, and then in the way that they covered what they did cover, there was a lot of bias involved in that. And, you know, a lot of listeners maybe don't remember, this is back in 1982 that Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted, but we saw both slanted media. And when I say slanted, I mean straight up lies. And I will let, I'd send folks to FAIR.org because we do have a lot of work on this, but I'll just give one example. In this case, in 1995, the Washington Post wrote a story that led with, it had this very gripping opening paragraph, which was Maureen Faulkner. That's the widow of Daniel Faulkner, who was killed in 1981. And it was her story about how when her husband's bloody shirt was held up in court, she said, Mumia Abu-Jamal turned around and smiled at her. This is her story about what happened in court. This is what the Washington Post is telling readers who maybe don't know much about it. This is what happened. Well, the thing is, as Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, Leonard Weinglass, said, and the court record showed, Mumia actually wasn't in court when the shirt was held up. So it was just a falsehood. And it was a falsehood that the Washington Post, the leading, you know, for many people, national newspaper, that was their leading anecdote. That was what they told readers to understand. And it was a straight up lie. And so that's an example of kind of what media did do, you know. And then there was a whole lot that they didn't do, you know. In 2006, Mumia Abu-Jamal won a right to appeal, as many listeners will know. And he won that on three grounds. One was that the jury had been purged of black people. His all-white jury had been, you know, purged in means that people were concerned about of African-Americans. One was that the prosecutor had misled the jurors in terms of telling them that their decision wouldn't be final, which is, you know, misleading the jury. And then also, in by 2006, it was understood that the judge, Albert Szabo, was biased, you know, six ways to Sunday, you know, but especially post-conviction. So in 2006, Mumia won this right to appeal, and it was a big deal. And yet, you're talking about local versus national, that wasn't interesting. That wasn't interesting to the Philadelphia local media. It wasn't interesting to national media. But particularly the Philadelphia Daily News told a reporter that Mumia's right to appeal was a non-issue, right? It was a non-issue. And the late great media critic Edward Herman wrote a lot about how the Philadelphia Inquirer ignored important developments in Mumia's case and then focused on things like counter protests, you know, whenever there were rallies around his, what many people believed and continue to believe, his unlawful conviction. So media did both. They both overcovered poorly the case itself. And then anytime problems were brought up with the case, with the conviction, those were ignored. And it was a very particular thing, NetFA, if I could just say real quick, you know, my take is in some ways that the way that corporate media covered this case, they hated the people who cared about Mumia, was a lot of the thing. You know, it wasn't just the support that corporate media often give to law enforcement, which of course is very important in this case. But it was also that as soon as actors and celebrities and musicians started coming out saying they thought that the trial was problematic, they thought that the conviction was problematic, they thought what was initially a death penalty was terrible, then corporate media took it on themselves to say, if celebrities care about this, if Hollywood cares about this, it must be stupid. And that kind of tainted corporate media's coverage of Mumia's story, I think, going forward.
So I was going to ask you about what kind of, being in that documentary, framing of an execution, I'm sure you probably had to prepare for it. And then we're also, in reflecting after it, it maybe afforded you some insights or epiphanies. Now, I think you somewhat touched on those, but maybe more in the line of what they did versus what it means. What does it tell you?
Well, you know, I would like to talk actually about the episode. I mean, some folks listening to this will not even know that ABC News used to have a show called 2020.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of a 60s
thing. They still have it.
It was, you know, folks will know. But, you know, they had this long form investigative show. And in 1998, they talked about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. And they used a lot of media techniques to really turn viewers who might have just been tuning in, didn't know anything about it. They used so many techniques that I think maybe now people would know about, but it was super powerful and super influential at the time, and it's worth talking about. I mean, some of it were just straight up lies. You know, Sam Donaldson, who was the host, you know, said during this 2020 episode that he just misrepresented the case fundamentally, you know, and said that three eyewitnesses all say they saw Jamal run from across the street and shoot the officers in the back. Like, he just stated the prosecution case as if it were fact. And that's kind of a telltale thing throughout the thing. So you would never guess from that one of the witnesses actually, when they were asked by police, did you see which male shot the officer, actually replied, no, all I saw was the flash from the gun. You wouldn't guess from Donaldson's characterization that another one of the witnesses misidentified Jamal after the shooting, and that another witness repeatedly changed their story multiple times after being arrested by police. So it gave this very one-sided characterization, and yet it then said, in Donaldson's words, this is part of the spectacular array of evidence for Mumia's guilt. You know, so they stated things that if a person were able to read the court record, they would know that this was just a re-quoting of the prosecution and that it ignored all kinds of other things. But as you're a TV viewer watching 2020, you don't know. But what I really also wanted to point out is, because as I say, the problem with media, some corporate media, was that it was a cause celeb. So this 2020 episode had Ed Asner. And they had him on, you know, they quoted him, and they quoted him saying, no ballistic tests were done, which is pretty stupid. Okay. And then you hear Sam Donaldson's voiceover cut in and say, but ballistic tests were done, you know?
Yeah,
so
I remember
he
that.
In, he countered, you know, he counters Ed Asner, except the thing is, when Donaldson says ballistics tests were done, he's talking about tests that said that the bullet that killed Daniel Faulkner was the same caliber or might have been the same caliber as Mumia Abu-Jamal's gun. He's not saying that there were ballistics done on the actual gun or that the gun had ever been fired or that there was nothing connecting the gun that they connected to Mumia. He's just saying, yeah, they did some ballistics tests, and he's not actually countering Ed Asner's point at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and the point is that police didn't perform any tests to see whether Mumia Abu-Jamal's gun had been fired, whether there was gunpowder residue on his hands. Those tests weren't done, and so what Asner was saying was completely correct. But Donaldson and ABC did this thing where, you know, they step in as the omniscient voice and tell the viewer, yeah, ignore this person, you know, and listen to me. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they were telling lies about that. And what I would finally say is when they did use interviews during that 2020 episode, when they did use some language from Mumia, first of all, they took audio from an interview. They didn't even get permission. They just took audio from another interview, which anybody who does media knows you don't do. And then the thing that they did was to add this like echo to it to they altered it, you know. And then finally, in case anyone wondered watching it, but the thing is, viewers of 2020 didn't know, but what journalists who dug into it afterwards found out was that when they tried to get an interview with Mumia at the time, which they didn't get, they stated flat out to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections that they were working with Maureen Faulkner, Daniel Faulkner's widow, and that they were working with the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police. So this is 2020. This is media saying they're doing a neutral or objective conversation, and in fact, they're using flat-out falsehoods, and they're also ignoring defense arguments and hyping prosecution arguments to a degree that really no journalist would consider acceptable. And this has kind of been par for the course in media's coverage of Mumia's case.
Mm-hmm. So right now, after 40 years, and then Mumia's been incarcerated for 40 years, most of those, well, I don't know about maybe half of them on death row or at this point. Well, he was taken off the death row in 2011, I think. But now, the whole lot of information, I don't know how much you've been keeping up with the case, has come out that make it, you know, really meaty, newsworthy story. You know, the boxes of evidence that were held in the DA's office, the judges that wouldn't recuse themselves with it after they presided, after being prosecutors in the case, and different things like that. But now the story's it's nothing. It's gone dark or you know, just kind of absent. What do you make of that? How can they get away with doing that? I guess they could just get away.
The story with Mumia has always been that he is an eloquent voice for incarcerated people and for people who corporate media would rather not hear from. And I feel that although much has changed, certainly since 1982, I feel that not that much has changed in many ways. And I still feel that as a voice for people that corporate media don't want to have a voice, that he still occupies that same place. And, you know, I looked up because I realized how long ago this has been, and it was kind of shocking to me, you know. So I thought, let me look at some recent coverage. And I found a thing from WHYY, which is public media in Philadelphia, you know, their public radio and television. And they were talking about, you know, he's just had his 67th birthday. He's just come through this heart surgery. And it said, and they're kind of, I often think you can find media in their little boilerplate, in their little snapshot of a story. And so, you know, they said, describing Mumia Abu-Jamal's case, WHYY said, the case has pitted Abu-Jamal's supporters, including a long list of national and international celebrities who say he was framed, against police and their supporters, who resent the attention given to a man convicted of murdering a fellow officer. So what that tells me, Netfa, is that for news media, it's still very much just a case about how people feel about it. It's like there's no reality there. Has a person been wrongly convicted? Has a person, even if they were rightly convicted, served a bizarre amount of time for the crime they've supposedly been convicted of? That's off the page. For news media, the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is just a case about how people feel about celebrities getting involved in issues and how people feel about police. And, it's lost its reality. It's lost the fact that this is a human being behind bars that we should care about and that represents many, many, many other people behind bars that we should care about and that we can't hear from. So I'm very frustrated to see how much media's coverage has not changed since the very beginning of this case when Mumia first went to jail.
Now, you know, a lot of there's so many lessons, though, in this struggle, and I've been involved with it to a degree in the struggle for Momia. So there's lessons in terms of legal battles and how they establish case law, the length in which the court system or the depth of which the court system, as you've put out, well, you actually talked about the media, but the court system also has been so, you know, corrupt in it. Also, the role of police unions, particularly the in this age of killings by police and the Black Lives Matter movement, that tells a lot in terms of, you know, the inability or the refusal to prosecute police officers. Now, of course, there's this victory around Chauvin, but that's, you know, that's one in so many. But I was wondering if there's similar lessons with someone who just deals with this in general, not just Mumia's case, but just everything. Like, what lessons you might hear if you're speaking to activists and organizers who are trying to, you know, engage in campaigns? How should we be viewing the media? How can we use or not depend? You know, when can we depend on the media or use the how should we use the media? And when should we not depend on media? And what can be some watchwords of how to determine when those things are viable or not?
Well, we have our own work. And to the extent that media help us, they help us. I think what we mainly learn is that we have our own media. And to the extent that people can talk to other people around and without corporate mediated media, we should do that. That's not to say that if you can get the New York Times to do a story, you know, go for that. But you cannot shape your message around what corporate media will accept or will broadcast, because they are not our friends. And I think the lesson from Mumia has been about how even once this man was in prison, corporate media went out of their way to continue to silence him. You know, Diane Sawyer from ABC interviewed Charles Manson, but was part of, you know, trying to make sure her and her network were part of trying to make sure that people would not be able to hear Mumia's voice. So you want the biggest megaphone you could get. But at the same time, I think we recognize from Mumia's case and from many others that to the extent that you are saying something that powerful people don't want to hear, you're not going to be able to rely on the platforms of the powerful to get that message out. Can you work around it? Absolutely. We do that on Twitter. We do that on social media, elsewhere. We do that everywhere there's a platform. You should get there. You should get your message out. You should talk about it. But we still have to recognize that there are reasons that NPR was going to air a series of commentaries from Mumia and then canceled it. There was a reason that other networks and folks were going to air Mumia's voice and then canceled it when their funding was threatened. So there are structural reasons why media can't deliver what we need them to deliver. And so we have to be aware of that and work around that to the extent that we can. And particularly when it comes to the voices of the incarcerated, we have to recognize that there's all kinds of barriers to getting those voices out. And anytime you can find an outlet that finds a way to get those voices out, you need to support that outlet and you need to support the ability to hear those voices. You know, Neva, one of the things that I think about when I think about this case is the fact that I would remember being at a media conference many years ago and hearing a labor organizer say, a left labor organizer say, the case of Mumia is dividing us, you know, and he said, people don't care about Mumia, they care about the economy. And to me, that represents the way that for many years on the left and the right and for corporate media, it's like it stopped being about a real human being and it became this meta story about, oh, well, if celebrities care about it, then it must be stupid. Or if Black people care about it, then it must not be about class. And it stopped being this actual compelling story that could have, you know, organized a lot of people and in fact did organize a lot of people around incarceration and over incarceration and about political prisoners.
But and the death penalty.
At a certain point, too many people made too many different things of it and it lost a core meaning, which I would hope in 2021 folks could get it together again and see how important this case is.
Yeah, I think it is. I think they are. I think it's starting that there's a newer generation that didn't, you know, they weren't really adults or anything then, but yeah, I think they're picking it up. You know, I think that I'm seeing signs that, you know, political prisoners are being on the forefront or among the demands and talked about. Maybe not like it should be yet, but it's happening.
I hope so.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Janine Jackson of FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and also Counterspin.
So FAIR's program Counterspin is on later this afternoon, I believe at 2:30, if the schedule's correct. That means it's on monthly, apparently, for a weekly program. It's an excellent program. You can seek it out at FAIR.org. Okay, here's Democracy Now!'s web exclusive. I commend also the interview, panel with, it's also a web exclusive, Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden. Excellent hour and a half segment. UMass Amherst has further segments from a weekend-long event featuring mainly Ellsberg. Look for that. Here's Surveillance Capitalism.
Bring you part two of our conversation with Shoshana Zuboff, author of The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. You recently wrote a piece for the New York Times titled, The Coup We Are Not Talking About. You write, we can have democracy or we can have a surveillance society, but we cannot have both. In part one of our discussion, Professor Zuboff, we talked about Facebook's oversight board appointed by Facebook to decide whether former President Trump can come back on Facebook. They said, we're giving Facebook another 6 months, but they upheld the suspension for now. Now I want to go to this very point that you and others have raised. Again, you write, we can have democracy or we can have a surveillance society, but we cannot have both. Explain.
Well, as I began to discuss before, these internet companies that, you know, began as little startups with really smart folks running them, learned early on that the way they could finally monetize their very interesting new services was to secretly extract behavioral data from human behavior from anywhere they could find it online. And later, you know, they gave us little pocket computers called smartphones so we could go out into the world, and that way they could get a lot more data. And what they learned was that by extracting predictive information from all this data that they could mine from our activity, they could analyze it, they could predict our future behavior. That became the product that they could sell to advertisers to target who was most likely to click on their ads and click through to the product or the service and whatever. That was the foundation of targeted online advertising. Now, this whole process of unilaterally invading our experience, turning it into data, extraordinarily then claiming those data as their private property for manufacture and for sales. This has turned into a dominant economic paradigm. It's not only the tech behemoths, it's the whole tech sector, it's every single app. Every app now is designed to maximize data collection from you, from your activity, from your behavior. And of course, it cuts across every industry now. So what's happened is, in these last 20 years, Amy, nobody wants to admit it, but the fact is what we have seen is the wholesale destruction of privacy in the last 20 years. There is no more privacy. And concomitant to that, you know, if you look at a company like Google or you look at a company like Facebook, these folks have accrued extraordinary power. A man like Mr. Zuckerberg, who has absolute control over Facebook, now essentially has absolute control over critical communications infrastructure that involves billions of people. And there is no countervailing force, no countervailing power when it comes to Mr. Zuckerberg and his decision rights. Just as was the case, you know, when we were fighting, John D. Rockefeller more than a century ago. So we are in a crazy situation. And when you ask the question, how do we get here? How did these companies, you know, how do we allow them to develop so much power over the, you know, central aspects of our society? The answer is that democracy did nothing. Democracy failed to intervene. Democracy was essentially either feeding its own need for human-generated data that it couldn't collect under the Constitution and under the public laws of our country. So it relied on these companies to collect it instead. And you know, in other respects, our lawmakers were asleep at the switch and allowed this power to grow unaccountably, totalistically, before they realized the threat it was to their own power. Because the long game here for surveillance capitalism is to substitute computational governance, governance by algorithms that they control for the sake of their commercial objectives, to substitute that for democratic governance. That is the long game, and there is evidence of that everywhere we look. In the meantime, this informational chaos that we have been experiencing, misinformation, disinformation, the absence of a public sphere online, because everything online now, all communications online are essentially owned and operated by surveillance capitalism. And Facebook is at the center of that because it's the largest social media space. So we have this communication space that is no longer a public sphere. It's a public sphere is the essential context when we talk about free speech. The idea that, you know, Justice Holmes and others have elaborated over the last 100 years is that, you know, free speech is so essential because in a public sphere, when you have free speech, the best ideas naturally rise to the top. The best ideas naturally get circulated to the most people and therefore adopted by the most people. So it's a kind of good version of survival of the fittest, you know, a positive version of that image. But the fact is that without a public sphere, we're stuck inside Facebook. Facebook is an economic machine. And as I mentioned before, it has to get the maximum amount of behavioral data to create great predictions, to have lucrative targeting to sell. How does it do that? Well, to get the maximum amount of data, you've got to get the maximum amount of extraction. And a few years ago, experts, academic researchers understood that false inflammatory information circulates more widely and is more widely engaged with than true, good, normal, common sense information. It's a little bit like you're, you know, driving down the highway. You don't stop to look at a beautiful tree. You stop to look at a horrible accident and back up traffic for, you know, 20 miles behind you. So this is how we're wired. Let's just say that for now. What Facebook learned to do, and others do it too, is to engineer their machine operations to take advantage of this. So the worst content, the most inflammatory, destructive, dangerous, false, bizarre, crazy content, the kind of content that in a public sphere, it would arise at the fringe and it would stay at the fringe in a normal society. It's crazy stuff. There are always going to be people spouting crazy stuff, but their ideas don't rise to the top. They stay at the margins where they belong. You don't need censorship to achieve that. You just need proper, normal, healthy social dynamics. But inside Facebook, we don't have that. We have this economic machine that is artificially selecting for amplification and allowing it to take over the center of this private square. And therefore, the craziest stuff overwhelms the good stuff. We have seen this most tragically. We're all focused on, you know, January 6th and the tragedies and outrageous challenge to democracy and the peaceful transition of power on that day, as well as the horrible death and destruction. But honestly, Amy, we have to look at the larger picture here, especially COVID disinformation. Columbia did a study. It came out late in the summer of 2020 when 217,000 American daughters and sons had died of COVID. And the question they asked was, how many of those deaths were avoidable? And the answer they came up with through a very stringent analysis was between 130,000 and 210,000 of those deaths could have been avoided, Amy. They were unnecessary. This is mass murder. So now we say, well, what made them unnecessary? They did an analysis and they came up with four key reasons for these avoidable deaths. And each of those reasons is related back to disinformation, the discrediting of public health authorities, the discrediting of wearing masks and so forth. Four key reasons that produce behaviors that caused all of these avoidable deaths. Now, let's put that next to key research that came now around the same time. And without going into all the details, the bottom line is that Cornell researchers determined that 40% of COVID disinformation that was circulating was produced by one dangerous influential, and his name was Donald Trump. All right, so the idea that Mr. Trump should have free access global information bloodstream on Facebook or anywhere else is an abhorrent, obscene thought. The man has showed his complete inhuman disinterest in life itself, as well as in the very functioning of our democracy, a democracy whose constitution he swore. So, president or no, does he deserve to be at the center of the global information bloodstream? Does he deserve to have the amenities of Facebook machine that automatically takes his most bizarre, disfigured, disgusting posts and amplifies them to the world, driving extremism and polarization, not only in the United States, but in every country? No, nobody deserves that, given the kinds of, you know, crimes against information and crimes against humanity that are evident here in Mr. Trump's callous and inhuman. So,
Shoshana, it's not just, as you well know, it's not just Trump and the disinformation campaign around COVID in the U.S. There was disinformation spread in many different languages all over the world via social media platforms like Facebook. But then Facebook pledged to crack down on this disinformation. What exactly happened, if anything?
Well, we know that Facebook's version of cracking down is not what you and I would think of as cracking down. Let me tell you what cracking down is. A few months ago, the Australian government was implementing a new code that would have required companies like Facebook and Google that essentially stole content from the newspaper industry in order to publish it in their spaces. And that hastened the demise of the newspaper industry as we knew it. And these companies, you know, never paid anything for it. On the contrary, they got rich on it. So here comes Australia saying, hey, we're finally going to make you pay for what you stole 15 years ago. Now, Google threatened to shut down search in Australia. But instead of making good on that threat, they did a backstage, a deal with Rupert Murdoch and his news empire, of course, based in Australia, and found a way forward that way so that the code would not apply to Google. But what did Facebook do? You want to know how Facebook acts when it really wants to? Facebook simply shut down its pages in Australia that had news links. Rather than negotiate with the Australian government, rather than face having to pay for using those news links and content, they simply vanished their pages. They could have done that with COVID disinformation because it was killing people. But they did not. Here's what they did. They put warnings on it. They put labels on it. And there's research, including internal Facebook research, showing that the labels meant nothing. Then, again, late summer 2020, Avast comes along with a very substantial study. They looked at 82 websites that had the worst COVID disinformation, and those websites were getting massive engagement. Then they selected the top 10 of those websites, the ones with the most views, the biggest websites with the most disinformation. And they looked at that exclusively for April 2020. And what they saw was that those top 10 bad, toxic, disfigured, crazy websites received 300 million views in April 2020, compared to the top 10 public health websites, like the CDC and the WHO, which received 70 million views that same month. So when you look, and then they dug down another level, and they looked at what was getting those 300 million engagements, and many of those posts that were getting those engagements already had Facebook warnings on them. And another major subset had no warnings on them, even though the fact checkers had already alerted Facebook to the fact that this was false information. This was disinformation. Turns out only about 16% of the disinformation that was fact-checked actually got a label on it, and then the labels were ignored. So
Professor,
when Facebook wants to act, when Google wants to act, they can act. They can shut it down. They can pull the plug. They can make sure that information never even gets there. They don't have to shut it down after the fact, after the horses are out of the barn. They can shut it down before it even gets there. And you know who forced them to do that? The Prime Minister of New Zealand, after the horrible Christchurch tragedy, she insisted that they shut down the videos of that horrible tragedy before they got posted. And in New Zealand, they did. We know they can choke off content before it enters the global information bloodstream if they want to. But again, they have an economic machine to feed, and they had political appeasement, always the sword of Damocles hanging over Zuckerberg's head. And he made a devil's pact early on that he was going to appease Trump. And when you understand that Trump was responsible for 40% of this disinformation, because Trump made a calculation right at the beginning of the pandemic, as I'm sure you know, he made a calculation right then that he could either try to actually govern America and fight the pandemic, or he could simply say that the pandemic was over or was going to be over, or that the vaccines were coming any day now, or that we'd all be back in church on Easter or whatever, and make a lot of people believe that, which was a lot easier than actually making it true.
So, Professor Zuboff, I wanted to ask you more about the role of private data brokers selling private information collected on internet users to the U.S. government and others. This is Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who sponsored the Fourth Amendment Is Not For Sale Act.
There ought to be transparency so that the American people know what kind of surveillance is being conducted on them. The President of the Senate knows about the important vote we had on that amendment that I offered, the bipartisan amendment with Senator Daines, because we ought to get history on whether the government is spying on the browsing history of the American people. So this is really a critical and growing concern, because we're all seeing about data brokers and others selling people's data. And it's especially important that the American people are told if the government is using legal loopholes in the law and the warrant requirement of the Fourth Amendment. So I asked Ms. Haynes about circumstances in which the government, instead of getting an order, just goes out and purchases the private records of Americans from these sleazy and unregulated commercial data brokers who are simply above the law.
So that was Senator Ron Wyden in January. CNN recently reported the Biden administration is considering working with private firms to conduct domestic surveillance. The proposal by the Department of Homeland Security would allow it to circumvent laws regulating domestic surveillance by doing it not through the government, but through these private companies. As we begin to wrap up, Professor Zuboff, if you could talk about how the significance of this and how surveillance capitalism could be most effectively challenged.
Well, you're absolutely right to play that by that Wyden clip. Senator Wyden is correct. The problem is that what he's saying is 20 years too late, because these companies, and I'm talking, beginning with Google, Google's model right from the start was surveillance. The only way they could get the behavioral data that they needed was to do it secretly. Otherwise, people would rebel and that would put friction into the system and they couldn't afford friction. So from the start, these were surveillance systems, but they were encouraged by the United States government in that post 9/11 environment. The NSA wanted to do surveillance that it couldn't do because of American laws, and instead encouraged the surveillance capabilities of these young companies, these young internet companies sprouting up in Silicon Valley, because they knew that as long as the data was collected in their servers, then they in Washington, they in the intelligence agencies would have a source. And to tell you just how deeply institutionalized this is, in 2013, the chief technology officer of the CIA spoke at a public conference, open to the public, mostly attended by tech nerds. And what he said at that conference was, quote, "We have to connect the dots. Since you can't connect dots you don't have, it drives us into a mode of fundamentally trying to collect everything and hang on to it forever. We take advantage of the massive information streams that have emerged on the planet. And we thank the internet companies, especially Google, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Fitbit, and the telecoms for making it possible." So this has been the status quo from the start. And this is one of the most pernicious legacies of the war on terror. I call it surveillance exceptionalism. This was another kind of pact with the devil that our government made in this moment of extreme pressure for total information awareness. Now, fast forward to our time, fast forward to the third decade of the 21st century, we've learned a lot. We've learned that these kinds of surveillance systems, even under private capital, are on a collision course with democracy. We know that they undermine human autonomy. They take our decision rights. They have completely destroyed privacy. They've blown by the Fourth Amendment. Forget about that. At the same time, they're changing democracy from the top down. Because as we've seen in the situation of Facebook, these companies now have huge asymmetries of knowledge. The difference between what we can know and what can be known about us is now an abyss. This is a whole new dimension of social inequality. And with that asymmetry of knowledge comes asymmetry of power, what they can do to us. And that comes in with the manipulation and behavior modification that is called targeting. So we're in a situation now where the public is onto this. If you look at the survey data, we're experiencing now a complete rupture of faith in the American public toward these companies and toward these sectors. We are seeing finally our lawmakers beginning to get the bit in their teeth, beginning to be willing to name this economic model and its roots in surveillance economics, surveillance capitalism, with a very specific mode of operation and extremely pernicious consequences for people and democracy. In those congressional hearings that we saw on March 24th of this year, for the first time, we saw leaders of Congress naming the economic model and naming the unaccountable power that the tech executives have accrued from these economics of surveillance, and saying, this is no longer going to stand. We are going to curb this unaccountable power that you are exercising over the American people, and indeed over the people of the world. So I believe we are at a crossroads, and all the elements are here for a turning point. The way we stop surveillance capitalism, to answer your final point there, is that we have to go after the supply and the demand. And by that, I mean, we have to challenge the original sin here, which is the secret, hidden, surveillance-based invasion of our personal space, our personal behavior, our personal experience, lifting out information that is then converted into behavioral data, which they then claim is their private property, and then turn it into their operations for manufacture and sales. That extraction, not only is it a parasitic form of economics, it doesn't create jobs, it doesn't create prosperity, it doesn't do all the things that we expect from a healthy capitalism, but it is, as we've said, undermining democracy at its roots and in its very structure. So the second thing that we do, we go after extraction, that's supply, and then we go after demand. Because where are these predictions of our behavior sold? Well, as I mentioned, it started in these online targeted advertising markets. What are these markets really? When you just think about it for a minute, what you realize is that these are markets trading in commodity futures of human behavior. These are human futures markets, whether it's insurance companies or retailers or finance companies or health companies or retail companies or the advertising industry. They are all in there bidding on predictions of what we will do soon and later, because that turns out to be extremely lucrative information. And the higher they bid, the greater the pressure on these companies to expand and deepen their extraction operations. So every app is an extraction tool, every so-called smart device, every so-called personalized service. And we're living now in this whole, you know, pervasive digital architecture of invasion and extraction. So we go after those markets and we simply make them illegal. Why not? We've made markets that trade in human beings illegal. We've made markets that trade in human organs illegal because they have predictably dangerous consequences for people in society. We can do the same thing with markets that trade in human futures because they drive the surveillance society. And the surveillance society is day by day suffocating the very possibility of democracy and the very capabilities within each individual citizen that we rely on to even imagine a healthy, functioning, flourishing democracy.
Shoshana Zuboff, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor emerita at Harvard Business School, author of the book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, The Fight for a Human Future and the New Frontier of Power. To see part one of our discussion, you can go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
And Bob, filling in for Paul Muth. Paul was heading down near the St. Louis area where he could spend some Mother's Day weekend with his mom down there. He hasn't seen her, I think, since before COVID hit. So it's my pleasure to fill in for him here at WEFT on News from Neptune. He prepared the show for you folks today. Sorry about the rough start to that because somebody renamed the file on me. I was looking for a different file name. Hey, let me get you a underwriting announcement going right here. WEFT Champaign.
Elliott Counseling Group has been providing compassionate mental health care to the community for nearly 20 years. Elliott Counseling Group offers counseling and behavioral health medication support and management to children, adolescents, and adults of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Champaign, Urbana, Tuscola, Charleston, Mattoon, and surrounding communities, with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066.
And welcome to Radio Free Labor here.